Identical twins share the entire genome. Fathers and mothers contribute on average half to their children, and so forth. If these variants can be sequenced and identified in each individual, lineage can be solved immediately. Relatedness is a function of mutatedness. Just as facial features or skin color or height are shared among related individuals, variations are more commonly shared within families than across families. Indeed, facial features and heights are shared because genetic variations are shared among individuals. And what if the geneticist is also asked to find the family with the most generations present, without knowing the ages of any of the individuals at the party? Suppose one family is represented by a great-grandfather, grandfather, father, and son at the celebration. Four generations are present. Another family also has four attendees, a father and his identical triplets, representing just two generations. Can we identify the family with the most generations in the crowd with no prior knowledge about faces or names? Merely counting the number of members in a family will not do. The father and triplet family, and the great-grandfather and his multi-generational descendants, each have the same number of family members, four. Genes and mutations provide a clever solution. Since mutations accumulate over generations, that is, over intergenerational time, the family with the greatest diversity in gene variations is the one with the most generations. The triplets have exactly the same genome. The genetic diversity is minimal. The great-grandfather and great-grandson pair, in contrast, have related genomes, but their genomes have the most differences. Evolution is a metronome, tick-tocking time through mutations. Genetic diversity thus acts as a molecular clock, and variations can organize lineage relationships. The intergenerational time between any two family members is proportional to the extent of genetic diversity between them. Wilson realized that this technique could be applied not just across a family, but across an entire population of organisms. Variations in genes could be used to create a map of relatedness, and genetic diversity could be used to measure the oldest populations within a species. A tribe that has the most genetic diversity within it is older than a tribe with little or no diversity. Wilson had almost solved the problem of estimating the age of any species using genomic information, except for a glitch. If genetic variation was produced only by mutation, Wilson's method would be absolutely failsafe. But genes, Wilson knew, are present in two copies in most human cells, and they can cross over between paired chromosomes, generating variation and diversity by an alternative method. This method of generating variation would inevitably confound Wilson's study. To construct an ideal genetic lineage, Wilson realized he needed a stretch of the human genes that was intrinsically resistant to reassortment and crossing over. A lonely, vulnerable corner of the genome where change can occur only through the accumulation of mutations, thereby allowing that genomic segment to act as the perfect molecular clock. But where might he find such a vulnerable stretch? Wilson's solution was ingenious. Human genes are stored in chromosomes in the nucleus of the cell, but with one exception. Every cell possesses a subcellular structure called a mitochondrion that is used to generate energy. Mitochondria have their own mini-genome, with only 37 genes, about 1/6,000th the number of genes on human chromosomes. Some scientists propose that mitochondria originated from some ancient bacteria that invaded single-celled organisms. These bacteria formed a symbiotic alliance with the organism. They provided energy but used the organism's cellular environment for nutrition, metabolism, and self-defense. The genes lodged within mitochondria are left over from this ancient symbiotic relationship. Indeed, human mitochondrial genes resemble bacterial genes more than human ones. The mitochondrial genome rarely recombines and is only present in a single copy. Mutations in mitochondrial genes are passed intact across generations, and they accumulate over time without crossing over, making the mitochondrial genome an ideal genetic timekeeper. Crucially, Wilson realized, this method of age reconstruction was entirely self-contained and independent of bias. It made no reference to the fossil record, to linguistic lineages, geologic strata, geographical maps, or anthropological surveys. Living humans are endowed with the evolutionary history of our species and our genomes. It is as if we permanently carry a photograph of each of our ancestors in our wallets. Between 1985 and 1995, Wilson and his students learned to apply these techniques to human specimens. Wilson died of leukemia in 1991, but his students continued his work. The results of these studies were startling for three reasons. First, when Wilson measured the overall diversity of the human mitochondrial genome, he found it to be surprisingly small, less diverse than the corresponding genomes of chimpanzees. Modern humans, in other words, are substantially younger and substantially more homogeneous than chimpanzees. Every chimp might look like every other chimp to human eyes, but to a discerning chimpanzee, it is humans that are vastly more alike. Calculating backward, the age of humans was estimated to be about 200,000 years, a minor blip, a tick-tock in the scale of evolution. Where did the first modern humans come from? By 1991, Wilson could use his method to reconstruct the lineage relationship between various populations across the globe and calculate the relative age of any population using genetic diversity as his molecular clock. As gene sequencing and annotation technologies evolved, geneticists refined this analysis, broadening its scope beyond mitochondrial variations and studying thousands of individuals across hundreds of populations around the world. In November 2008, a seminal study led by Luigi Cavalli-Savorsa, Marcus Feldman, and Richard Myers from Stanford University characterized 642,690 genetic variants in 938 individuals, drawn from 51 subpopulations across the world. The second startling result about human origins emerges from this study. Modern humans appear to have emerged exclusively from a rather narrow slice of Earth, somewhere in sub-Saharan Africa, about 100 to 200,000 years ago, and then migrated northward and eastward to populate the Middle East, Europe, Asia, and the Americas. "You get less and less variation the further you go from Africa," Feldman wrote. Such a pattern fits the theory that the first modern humans settled the world in stepping stone fashion after leaving Africa less than 100,000 years ago. As each small group of people broke away to found a new region, it took only a sample of the parent population's genetic diversity. The oldest human populations, their genomes peppered with diverse and ancient variations, are the sand tribes of South Africa, Namibia, and Botswana, and the Mbuti pygmies, who live deep in the Ituri forests in the Congo. The youngest humans, in contrast, are the indigenous North Americans who left Europe and crossed into the Seward Peninsula in Alaska through the icy cleft of the Bering Strait some 15 to 30,000 years ago. This theory of human origin and migration, corroborated by fossil specimens, geological data, tools from archaeological digs, and linguistic patterns, has overwhelmingly been accepted by most human geneticists. It is called the out-of-Africa theory, or the recent out-of-Africa model, the recent reflecting the surprisingly modern evolution of modern humans, and its acronym, ROAM, a loving memento to an ancient peripatetic urge that seems to rise directly out of our genomes. The third important conclusion of these studies requires some conceptual background. Consider the genesis of a single-celled embryo produced by the fertilization of an egg by a sperm. The genetic material of this embryo comes from two sources, paternal genes from sperm and maternal genes from eggs. But the cellular material of the embryo comes exclusively from the egg. The sperm is no more than a glorified delivery vehicle for male DNA, a genome equipped with a hyperactive tail. Aside from proteins, ribosomes, nutrients, and membranes, the egg also supplies the embryo with specialized structures called mitochondria. These mitochondria are the energy-producing factories of the cell. They are so anatomically discrete and so specialized in their function that cell biologists call them organelles, that is, mini-organs resident within cells. Mitochondria, recall, carry a small independent genome that resides within the mitochondrion itself, not in the cell's nucleus, where the 23 pairs of chromosomes and the 21,000-odd human genes can be found. The exclusively female origin of all the mitochondria in an embryo has an important consequence. All humans, male or female, must have inherited their mitochondria from their mothers, who inherited their mitochondria from their mothers, and so forth, in an unbroken line of female ancestry stretching indefinitely into the past. A woman also carries the mitochondrial genomes of all her future descendants in her cells. Ironically, if there is such a thing as a homunculus, then it is exclusively female in origin. Technically, a femunculus? Now, imagine an ancient tribe of 200 women, each of whom bears one child. If the child happens to be a daughter, the woman dutifully passes her mitochondria to the next generation, and through her daughter's daughter to a third generation. But if she has only a son and no daughter, the woman's mitochondrial lineage wanders into a genetic blind alley and becomes extinct. Since sperm do not pass their mitochondria to the embryo, sons cannot pass their mitochondrial genomes to their children. Over the course of the tribe's evolution, tens of thousands of such mitochondrial lineages will land on lineal dead ends by chance and be snuffed out. And here's the crux. If the founding population of a species is small enough, and if enough time has passed, the number of surviving maternal lineages will keep shrinking and shrinking further until only a few are left. If half of the 200 women in our tribe have sons, and only sons, then 100 mitochondrial lineages will dash against the glass pane of male-only heredity and vanish in the next generation. Another half will dead-end into male children in the second generation, and so forth. By the end of several generations, all the descendants of the tribe, male or female, might track their mitochondrial ancestry to just a few women. For modern humans, that number has reached one. Each of us can trace our mitochondrial lineage to a single human female who existed in Africa about 200,000 years ago. She is the common mother of our species. We do not know what she looked like, although her closest modern-day relatives are women of the Sand tribe from Botswana or Namibia. I find the idea of such a founding mother endlessly mesmerizing. In human genetics, she is known by a beautiful name, Mitochondrial Eve. In the summer of 1994, as a graduate student interested in the genetic origin of the immune system, I traveled along the Rift Valley from Kenya to Zimbabwe, past the basin of the Zambezi River to the flat plains of South Africa. It was the evolutionary journey of humans in reverse. The final station of the journey was an arid mesa in South Africa, roughly equidistant from Namibia and Botswana, where some of the sand tribes once lived. It was a place of lunar desolation, a flat, dry tabletop of land decapitated by some geophysically vengeful force and perched upon the plains below. By then, a series of thefts and losses had whittled my possessions down to virtually nothing. 4 pairs of boxers, which I often doubled up and wore as shorts, a box of protein bars, and bottled water. Naked we come, the Bible suggests. I was almost there. With a little imagination, we can reconstruct the history of humans using that wind-blown mesa as a starting point. The clock begins about 200,000 years ago, when a population of early modern humans begins to inhabit this site, or some such site in its vicinity. The evolutionary geneticists Brenna Henn, Marcus Feldman, and Sarah Tishkoff have pinpointed the origin of human migration farther west, near the coast of Namibia. We know virtually nothing about the culture and habits of this ancient tribe. They left no artifacts, no tools, no drawings, no cave dwellings, except the most profound of all remnants, their genes, stitched indelibly into our own. The population was likely quite small, even minuscule by contemporary standards, no more than about 6,000 or 10,000 individuals. The most provocative estimate is a bare 700, about the number of humans that might inhabit a single city block or a village. Mitochondrial Eve may have lived among them, bearing at least one daughter and at least one granddaughter. We do not know when or why these individuals stopped interbreeding with other hominids, but we do know that they began breeding with each other with relative exclusivity about 200 millennia ago. Sexual intercourse began, the poet Philip Larkin once wrote, in 1963. He was off by about 200,000 years. Perhaps they were isolated here by climate changes or stranded by geographic barriers. Perhaps they fell in love. From here they went west, as young men often do, and then traveled north. They clambered through the gash of the Rift Valley or ducked into the canopies of the humid rainforests around the Congo Basin, where the Mbuti and Bantu now live. The story is not as geographically contained or as neat as it sounds. Some populations of early modern humans are known to have wandered back into the Sahara, a lush landscape then, crisscrossed with finger lakes and rivers, and eddied backward into local pools of humanoids, coexisted and even interbred with them, perhaps generating evolutionary backcrosses. As Christopher Stringer, the paleoanthropologist, described it, in terms of modern humans, this means that some modern humans have got more archaic genes than others. That does seem to be so, so it leads us on to ask again, what is a modern human? Some of the most fascinating ongoing research topics in the next year or two will be homing in on the DNA that some of us have acquired from Neanderthals. Scientists will look at that DNA and ask, is it functional? Is it actually doing something in the bodies of those people? Is it affecting brains, anatomy, physiology, and so on? But the long march went on. Some 75,000 years ago, a group of humans arrived at the northeastern edge of Ethiopia, or Egypt, where the Red Sea narrows to a slit-like strait between the shrugged shoulder of Africa and the downward elbow of the Yemeni Peninsula. There was no one there to part the ocean. We do not know what drove these men and women to fling themselves across the water, or how they managed to cross it. The sea was shallower then, and some geologists have wondered whether chains of sandbar islands spanned the strait along which our ancestors hopscotched their way to Asia and Europe. A volcano had erupted in Toba, Indonesia, about 70,000 years ago, spewing enough dark ash into the skies to launch a decades-long winter that might have precipitated a desperate search for new food and land. Others have proposed that multiple dispersals, prompted by smaller catastrophes, may have taken place at various times in human history. One dominant theory suggests that at least two independent crossings occurred. The earliest crossing occurred 130,000 years ago. The migrants landed in the Middle East and took a beachcomber route through Asia, hugging the coast toward India and then fanning out southward toward Burma, Malaysia, and Indonesia. A later crossing happened more recently, about 60,000 years ago. These migrants moved north into Europe, where they encountered Neanderthals. Either route used the Yemeni Peninsula as its hub. This is the true melting pot of the human genome. What is certain is that every perilous ocean crossing left hardly any survivors, perhaps as few as 600 men and women. Europeans, Asians, Australians, and Americans are the descendants of these drastic bottlenecks, and this corkscrew of history, too, has left its signature in our genomes. In a genetic sense, nearly all of us who emerged out of Africa, gasping for land and air, are even more closely yoked than previously imagined. We were on the same boat, brother. What does this tell us about race and genes? A great deal. First, it reminds us that the racial categorization of humans is an inherently limited proposition. Wallace Sayer, the political scientist, like to quip that academic disputes are often the most vicious because the stakes are so overwhelmingly low. By similar logic, perhaps our increasingly shrill debates on race should begin with the recognition that the actual range of human genomic variation is strikingly low. Lower than in many other species. Lower, remember, than in chimpanzees. Given our rather brief tenure on Earth as a species, we are much more alike than unlike each other. It is an inevitable consequence of the bloom of our youth that we haven't even had time to taste the poison apple. Yet even a young species possesses history. One of the most penetrating powers of genomics is its ability to organize even closely related genomes into classes and subclasses. If we go hunting for discriminatory features and clusters, then we will, indeed, find features and clusters to discriminate. Examined carefully, the variations in the human genome will cluster in geographic regions and continents and along traditional boundaries of race. Every genome bears the mark of its ancestry. By studying the genetic characteristics of an individual, you can pinpoint his or her origin to a certain continent, nationality, state, or even a tribe with remarkable accuracy. It is, to be sure, an apotheosis of small differences, but if this is what we mean by race, then the concept has not just survived the genomic era, it has been amplified by it. The problem with racial discrimination, though, is not the inference of a person's race from their genetic characteristics. It is quite the opposite. It is the inference of a person's characteristics from their race. The question is not, can you, given an individual's skin color, hair, texture, or language, infer something about their ancestry or origin? That is a question of biological systematics, of lineage, of taxonomy, of racial geography, of biological discrimination. Of course you can, and genomics has vastly refined that inference. You can scan any individual genome and infer rather deep insights about a person's ancestry or place of origin, but the vastly more controversial question is the converse. Given a racial identity, African or Asian, say, can you infer anything about an individual's characteristics, not just skin or hair color, but more complex features such as intelligence, habits, personality, and aptitude? Genes can certainly tell us about race, but can race tell us anything about genes? To answer this question, we need to measure how genetic variation is distributed across various racial categories. Is there more diversity within races or between races? Does knowing that someone is of African versus European descent, say, allow us to refine our understanding of their genetic traits or their personal, physical, or intellectual attributes in a meaningful manner? Or is there so much variation within Africans and Europeans that intra-racial diversity dominates the comparison, thereby making the category African or European moot? We now know precise and quantitative answers to these questions. A number of studies have tried to quantify the level of genetic diversity of the human genome. The most recent estimates suggest that the vast proportion of genetic diversity, 85 to 90%, occurs within so-called races, that is, within Asians or Africans, and only a minor proportion, 7%, between racial groups. The geneticist Richard Lewontin had estimated a similar distribution as early as 1972. Some genes certainly vary sharply between racial or ethnic groups. Sickle cell anemia is an Afro-Caribbean and Indian disease, and Tay-Sachs disease has a much higher frequency in Ashkenazi Jews. But for the most part, the genetic diversity within any racial group dominates the diversity between racial groups, not marginally, but by an enormous amount. This degree of intra-racial variability makes race a poor surrogate for nearly any feature. In a genetic sense, an African man from Nigeria is so different from another man from Namibia that it makes little sense to lump them into the same category. For race and genetics, then, the genome is a strictly one-way street. You can use genome to predict where X or Y came from, but knowing where A or B came from, you can predict little about the person's genome. Or, every genome carries a signature of an individual's ancestry, but an individual's racial ancestry predicts little about the person's genome. You can sequence DNA from an African-American man and conclude that his ancestors came from Sierra Leone or Nigeria. But if you encounter a man whose great-grandparents came from Nigeria or Sierra Leone, you can say little about the features of this particular man. The geneticist goes home happy. The racist returns empty-handed. As Marcus Feldman and Richard Lewontin put it, racial assignment loses any general biological interest. For the human species, racial assignment of individuals does not carry any general implication about genetic differentiation. In his monumental study on human genetics, Migration and Race, published in 1994, Luigi Cavalli-Savorsa, the Stanford geneticist, described the problem of racial classification as a futile exercise, driven by cultural arbitration rather than genetic differentiation. The level at which we stop our classification is completely arbitrary. We can identify clusters of populations, but since every level of clustering would determine a different partition, there is no biological reason to prefer a particular one. Cavalli-Savorsa continued, "The evolutionary explanation is simple. There is great genetic variation in populations, even in small ones. This individual variation has accumulated over long periods, because most genetic variations antedate the separation into continents, and perhaps even the origin of the species less than 500,000 years ago. There has, therefore, been too little time for the accumulation of substantial divergence." That extraordinary last statement was written to address the past. It is a measured scientific retort to Agassiz and Galton, to the American eugenicists of the 19th century, and to the Nazi geneticists of the 20th. Genetics unleashed the specter of scientific racism in the 19th century. Genomics, thankfully, has stuffed it back into its bottle. Or, as A.B., the African-American maid, tells Mae Mobley plainly in The Help, "So we's the same, just a different color." In 1994, the very year that Luigi Cavalli-Savorsa published his comprehensive review of race and genetics, Americans were convulsing with anxiety around a very different kind of book about race and genes. Written by Richard Herrnstein, the behavioral psychologist, and Charles Murray, a political scientist, The Bell Curve was, as the Times described it, a flame-throwing treatise on class, race, and intelligence. The Bell Curve offered a glimpse of how easily the language of genes and race can be distorted, and how potently those distortions can reverberate through a culture that is obsessed with heredity and race. As public flamethrowers go, Herrnstein was an old hand. His 1985 book, Crime and Human Nature, had ignited its own firestorm of controversy by claiming that ingrained characteristics, such as personality and temperament, were linked to criminal behavior. A decade later, the Bell Curve made an even more incendiary set of claims. Murray and Herrnstein proposed that intelligence was also largely ingrained, that is, genetic, and that it was unequally segregated among races. Whites and Asians possessed higher IQs on average, and Africans and African Americans possessed lower IQs. This difference in intellectual capacity, Murray and Herrnstein claimed, was largely responsible for the chronic underperformance of African Americans in social and economic spheres. African Americans were lagging behind in the United States, not because of systematic flaws in our social contracts, but because of systematic flaws in their mental constructs. To understand the Bell Curve, we need to begin with a definition of intelligence. Predictably, Murray and Herrnstein chose a narrow definition of intelligence, one that brings us back to 19th century biometrics and eugenics. Galton and his disciples, we might recall, were obsessed with the measurement of intelligence. Between 1890 and 1910, dozens of tests were devised in Europe and America that purported to measure intelligence in some unbiased and quantitative manner. In 1904, Charles Spearman, a British statistician, noted an important feature of these tests. People who did well in one test generally tended to do well in another test. Spearman hypothesized that this positive correlation existed because all the tests were obliquely measuring some mysterious common factor. This factor, Spearman proposed, was not knowledge itself, but the capacity to acquire and manipulate abstract knowledge. Spearman called it general intelligence. He labeled it G. By the early 20th century, G had caught the imagination of the public. First, it captivated early eugenicists. In 1916, the Stanford psychologist Lewis Terman, an avid supporter of the American eugenics movement, created a standardized test to rapidly and quantitatively assess general intelligence, hoping to use the test to select more intelligent humans for eugenic breeding. Recognizing that this measurement varied with age during childhood development, Terman advocated a new metric to quantify age-specific intelligence. If a subject's mental age was the same as his or her physical age, their intelligence quotient, or IQ, was defined as exactly 100. If a subject lagged in mental age compared to physical age, the IQ is less than 100. If she was more mentally advanced, she was assigned an IQ above 100. A numerical measure of intelligence was also particularly suited to the demands of the First and Second World Wars, during which recruits had to be assigned to wartime tasks requiring diverse skills based on rapid quantitative assessments. When veterans returned to civilian life after the wars, they found their lives dominated by intelligence testing. By the early 1940s, such tests had become accepted as an inherent part of American culture. IQ tests were used to rank job applicants, place children in school, and recruit agents for the Secret Service. In the 1950s, Americans commonly listed their IQs on their resumes, submitted the results of a test for a job application, or even chose their spouses based on the test. IQ scores were pinned on the babies who were on display in Better Babies contests, although how IQ is measured in a 2-year-old remained mysterious. These rhetorical and historical shifts in the concept of intelligence are worth noting, for we will return to them in a few paragraphs. General intelligence, G, originated as a statistical correlation between tests given under particular circumstances to particular individuals. It morphed into the notion of general intelligence because of a hypothesis concerning the nature of human knowledge acquisition, and it was codified into IQ to serve the particular exigencies of war. In a cultural sense, the definition of G was an exquisitely self-reinforcing phenomenon. Those who possessed it anointed as intelligent and given the arbitration of the quality, had every incentive in the world to propagate its definition. Richard Dawkins, the evolutionary biologist, once defined a meme as a cultural unit that spreads virally through societies by mutating, replicating, and being selected. We might imagine G as such a self-propagating unit. We might even call it a selfish G. It takes counterculture to counterculture, and it was only inevitable, perhaps, that these sweeping political movements that gripped America in the 1960s and 1970s would shake the notions of general intelligence and IQ by their very roots. As the civil rights movement and feminism highlighted chronic political and social inequalities in America, it became evident that biological and psychological features were not just inborn, but likely to be deeply influenced by context and environment. The dogma of a single form of intelligence was also challenged by scientific evidence. Developmental psychologists such as Lewis Thurstone in the 50s and Howard Gardner in the late 70s argued that general intelligence was a rather clumsy way to lump together many vastly more context-specific and subtle forms of intelligence, such as visuospatial, mathematical, or verbal intelligence. A geneticist, revisiting this data, might have concluded that G, the measurement of a hypothetical quality invented to serve a particular context, might be a trait barely worth linking to genes, but this hardly dissuaded Murray and Herrnstein. Drawing heavily from an earlier article by the psychologist Arthur Jensen, Murray and Herrnstein set out to prove that G was heritable, that it varied between ethnic groups, and, most crucially, that the racial disparity was due to inborn genetic differences between whites and African Americans. Is G heritable? In a certain sense, yes. In the 1950s, a series of reports suggested a strong genetic component. Of these, twin studies were the most definitive. When identical twins who had been reared together, that is, with shared genes and shared environments, were tested in the early 50s, psychologists had found a striking degree of concordance in their IQs, with a correlation value of 0.86. In the late 80s, when identical twins who were separated at birth and reared separately were tested, the correlation fell to 0.74, still a striking number. But the heritability of a trait, no matter how strong, may be the result of multiple genes, each exerting a relatively minor effect. If that was the case, identical twins would show strong correlations in G, but parents and children would be far less concordant. IQ followed this pattern. The correlation between parents and children living together, for instance, fell to 0.42. With parents and children living apart, the correlation collapsed to 0.22. Whatever the IQ test was measuring, it was a heritable factor, but one also influenced by many genes and possibly strongly modified by environment, part nature and part nurture. The most logical conclusion from these facts is that while some combination of genes and environments can strongly influence G, this combination will rarely be passed intact from parents to their children. Mendel's laws virtually guarantee that the particular permutation of genes will scatter apart in every generation, and environmental interactions are so difficult to capture and predict that they cannot be reproduced over time. Intelligence, in short, is heritable, that is, influenced by genes, but not easily inheritable, that is, moved down intact from one generation to the next. Had Murray and Herrnstein reached these conclusions, they would have published an accurate, if rather uncontroversial, book on the inheritance of intelligence. But the molten centerpiece of the bell curve is not the heritability of IQ, but its racial distribution. Murray and Herrnstein began by reviewing 156 independent studies that had compared IQs between races. Taken together, these studies had found an average IQ of 100 for whites. By definition, the average IQ of the index population has to be 100, and 85 for African Americans, a 15-point difference. Murray and Herrnstein tried, somewhat valiantly, to ferret out the possibility that the tests were biased against African Americans. They limited the tests to only those administered after 1960 and only given outside the South, hoping to curtail endemic biases, but the 15-point difference persisted. Could the difference in black-white IQ scores be a result of socioeconomic status? That impoverished children, regardless of race, perform worse in IQ tests had been known for decades. Indeed, of all the hypotheses concerning the difference in racial IQs, this was by far the most plausible, that the vast part of the black-white difference may be the consequence of the overrepresentation of poor African-American children. In the 1990s, the psychologist Eric Turkheimer strongly validated this theory by demonstrating that genes play a rather minor role in determining IQ in severely impoverished circumstances. If you superpose poverty, hunger, and illness on a child, then these variables dominate the influence on IQ. Genes that control IQ only become significant if you remove these limitations. It is easy to demonstrate an analogous effect in a lab. If you raise two plant strains, one tall and one short, in undernourished circumstances, then both plants grow short regardless of intrinsic genetic drive. In contrast, when nutrients are no longer limiting, the tall plant grows to its full height. Whether genes or environment, nature or nurture, dominates an influence depends on context. When environments are constraining, they exert a disproportionate influence. When the constraints are removed, genes become ascendant. The effects of poverty and deprivation offered a perfectly reasonable cause for the overall black-white difference in IQ, but Murray and Herrnstein dug deeper. Even correcting for socioeconomic status, they found the black-white score difference could not be fully eliminated. If you plot a curve of IQ of whites and African Americans across increasing socioeconomic status, the IQ increases in both cases, as expected. Wealthier children certainly score better than their poorer counterparts, both in white and in African American populations. Yet the difference between the IQ scores across races persists. Indeed, paradoxically, the difference increases as you increase the socioeconomic status of whites and African Americans. The difference in IQ scores between wealthy whites and wealthy African Americans is even more pronounced. Far from narrowing, the gap widens at the top brackets of income. Quarts and quarts of ink have been spilled in books, magazines, scientific journals, and newspapers, analyzing, cross-examining, and debunking these results. In a blistering article written for The New Yorker, for instance, the evolutionary biologist Stephen Jay Gould argued that the effect was far too mild and the variation within tests was far too great to make any statistical conclusions about the difference. The Harvard historian Orlando Patterson, in the slyly titled For Whom the Bell Curves, reminded readers that the frayed legacies of slavery, racism, and bigotry had deepened the cultural rifts between whites and African Americans so dramatically that biological attributes across races could not be compared in a meaningful way. Indeed, the social psychologist Claude Steele demonstrated that when black students are asked to take an IQ test, under the pretext that they are being tested to try out a new electronic pen or a new way of scoring, they perform well. Told that they are being tested for intelligence, however, their scores collapse. The real variable being measured, then, is not intelligence, but an aptitude for test-taking, or self-esteem, or simply ego or anxiety. In a society where black men and women experience routine, pervasive, and insidious discrimination, such a propensity could become fully self-reinforcing. Black children do worse at tests because they've been told that they are worse at tests, which makes them perform badly in tests and furthers the idea that they are less intelligent, ad infinitum. But the final fatal flaw in the bell curve is something far simpler, a fact buried so inconspicuously in a single throwaway paragraph in an 800-page book that it virtually disappears. If you take African Americans and whites with identical IQ scores, say 105, and measure their performance in various subtests for intelligence, black children often score better in certain sets, tests of short-term memory and recall, for instance, while whites often score better in others, tests of visuospatial and perceptual changes. In other words, the way an IQ test is configured profoundly affects the way different racial groups and their gene variants perform on it. Alter the weights and balances within the same test, and you alter the measure of intelligence. The strongest evidence for such a bias comes from a largely forgotten study performed by Sandra Scar and Richard Weinberg in 1976. Scar studied transracial adoptees, black children adopted by white parents, and found that these children had an average IQ of 106, at least as high as white children. By analyzing carefully performed controls, Scar concluded that intelligence was not being enhanced, but performance on particular subtests of intelligence. We cannot shrug this proposition away by suggesting that the current construction of the IQ test must be correct since it predicts performance in the real world. Of course it does, because the concept of IQ is powerfully self-reinforcing. It measures a quality imbued with enormous meaning and value whose job it is to propagate itself. The circle of its logic is perfectly closed and impenetrable, yet the actual configuration of the test is relatively arbitrary. You do not render the word intelligence meaningless by shifting the balance in a test, from visuospatial perception to short-term recall, say, but you do shift the black-white IQ score discrepancy. And therein lies the rub. The tricky thing about the notion of G is that it pretends to be a biological quality that is measurable and heritable, while it is actually strongly determined by cultural priorities. It is, to simplify it somewhat, the most dangerous of all things, a meme masquerading as a gene. If the history of medical genetics teaches us one lesson, it is to be wary of precisely such slips between biology and culture. Humans, we now know, are largely similar in genetic terms, but with enough variation within us to represent true diversity. Or, perhaps more accurately, we are culturally or biologically inclined to magnify variations, even if they are minor in the larger scheme of the genome. Tests that are explicitly designed to capture variances in abilities will likely capture variances in abilities, and these variations may well track along racial lines, but to call the score in such a test intelligence, especially when the score is uniquely sensitive to the configuration of the test, is to insult the very quality it sets out to measure. Genes cannot tell us how to categorize or comprehend human diversity. Environments can, cultures can, geographies can, histories can. Our language sputters in its attempt to capture this slip. When a genetic variation is statistically the most common, we call it normal, a word that implies not just superior statistical representation, but qualitative or even moral superiority. Merriam-Webster's dictionary has no less than 8 definitions of the word, including occurring naturally and mentally and physically healthy. When the variation is rare, it is termed a mutant, a word that implies not just statistical uncommonness, but qualitative inferiority, or even moral repugnance. And so it goes, interposing linguistic discrimination on genetic variation, mixing biology and desire. When a gene variant reduces an organism's fitness in a particular environment, a hairless man in Antarctica, we call the phenomenon genetic illness. When the same variant increases fitness in a different environment, we call the organism genetically enhanced. The synthesis of evolutionary biology and genetics reminds us that these judgments are meaningless. Enhancement or illness are words that measure the fitness of a particular genotype to a particular environment. If you alter the environment, the words can even reverse their meanings. When nobody read, the psychologist Alison Gopnik writes, dyslexia wasn't a problem. When most people had to hunt, a minor genetic variation in your ability to focus attention was hardly a problem, and may even have been an advantage, enabling a hunter to maintain his focus on multiple and simultaneous targets, for instance. When most people have to make it through high school, the same variation can become a life-altering disease. The desire to categorize humans along racial lines and the impulse to superpose attributes such as intelligence or criminality, creativity, or violence on those lines illustrates a general theme concerning genetics and categorization. Like the English novel or The Face, say, the human genome can be lumped or split in a million different ways. But whether to split or lump, to categorize or synthesize, is a choice. When a distinct heritable biological feature, such as a genetic illness, for example sickle cell anemia, is the ascendant concern, then examining the genome to identify the locus of that feature makes absolute sense. The narrower the definition of the heritable feature or the trait, the more likely we will find a genetic locus for that trait, and the more likely that the trait will segregate within some human subpopulation. Ashkenazi Jews in the case of Tay-Sachs disease, or Afro-Caribbeans for sickle cell anemia. There's a reason that marathon running, for instance, is becoming a genetic sport. Runners from Kenya and Ethiopia, a narrow eastern wedge of one continent, dominate the race not just because of talent and training, but also because the marathon is a narrowly defined test for a certain form of extreme fortitude. Genes that enable this fortitude, for example, particular combinations of gene variants that produce distinct forms of anatomy, physiology, and metabolism, will be naturally selected. Conversely, the more we widen the definition of a feature or trait, say intelligence or temperament, the less likely that the trait will correlate with single genes and, by extension, with races, tribes, or subpopulations. Intelligence and temperament are not marathon races. There are no fixed criteria for success, no start or finish lines, and running sideways or backward might secure victory. The narrowness or breadth of the definition of a feature is, in fact, a question of identity. That is, how we define, categorize, and understand humans, ourselves, in a cultural, social, and political sense. The crucial missing element in our blurred conversation on the definition of race, then, is a conversation on the definition of identity. The first derivative of identity. For several decades, anthropology has participated in the general deconstruction of identity as a stable object of scholarly inquiry. The notion that individuals craft their identity through social performances, and hence that their identity is not a fixed essence, fundamentally drives current research into gender and sexuality. The notion that collective identity emerges out of political struggle and compromise underlies contemporary studies of race, ethnicity, and nationalism. Paul Broadwin, Genetics, Identity, and the Anthropology of Essentialism. Methinks you are my glass and not my brother. William Shakespeare, The Comedy of Errors, Act 5, Scene 1. On October 6, 1942, 5 years before my father's family left Barishal, my mother was born twice in Delhi. Bulu, her identical twin, came before her, placid and beautiful. My mother, Tulu, emerged several minutes later, squirming and crying murderously. The midwife must fortunately have known enough about infants to recognize that the most beautiful are often the most damned. The quiet twin on the edge of listlessness was quite severely undernourished and had to be swaddled in blankets and revived. The first few days of my aunt's life were the most tenuous. She could not suckle at the breast, the story runs, perhaps apocryphally, and there were no infant bottles to be found in Delhi in the 40s, so she was fed through a cotton wick dipped in milk, and then from the caul of a cowrie shell shaped like a spoon. A nurse was hired to tend to her. When the breast milk began to run dry at 7 months, my mother was quickly weaned to let her sister have its last remnants. Right from the onset, then, my mother and her twin were living experiments in genetics, emphatically identical in nature and emphatically divergent in nurture. My mother, the younger of the two by minutes, was boisterous. She had a slippery, mercurial temper. She was carefree and fearless, fast to learn and willing to make mistakes. Bulu was physically timid. Her mind was more agile, her tongue sharper, her wit more lancing. Tulu was gregarious. She made friends easily. She was impervious to insults. Bulu was reserved and restrained, quieter and more brittle. Tulu liked theater and dancing. Bulu was a poet, a writer, a dreamer. Yet the contrasts only highlighted the similarities between the twins. Tulu and Bulu looked strikingly similar. They had the same freckled skin, almond-shaped face, and high cheekbones, unusual among Bengalis, and the slight downward tilt of the outer edge of the eye, the trick that Italian painters used to make Madonna seem to exude a mysterious empathy. They shared the inner language that twins often share. They had jokes that only the other twin understood. Over the years, their lives drifted apart. Tulu married my father in 1965. He had moved to Delhi 3 years earlier. It was an arranged marriage, but also a risky one. My father was a penniless immigrant in a new city, saddled with a domineering mother and a half-mad brother who lived at home. To my mother's overly genteel West Bengali relatives, my father's family was the very embodiment of East Bengali hickness. When his brothers sat down to lunch, they would pile their rice in mounds and punch volcanic holes in it for gravy. as if marking the insatiable perpetual hunger of their village days in the form of craters on their plates. Bulu's marriage seemed a vastly safer prospect by comparison. In 1966, she was engaged to a young lawyer, the eldest son of a well-established clan in Calcutta. In 1967, Bulu married him and moved to his family's sprawling, decrepit mansion in South Calcutta, with a garden already choked by weeds. By the time I was born, in 1970, the sisters' fortunes had started to move in unexpected directions. In the late 1960s, Calcutta began its steady descent into hell. Its economy was fraying, its tenuous infrastructure heaving under the weight of waves of immigration. Internecine political movements broke out frequently, shuttering the streets and businesses for weeks. As the city convulsed between cycles of violence and apathy, Bulu's new family hemorrhaged its savings to keep itself afloat. Her husband kept up the pretense of a job, leaving home every morning with the requisite briefcase and tiffin box, but who needed a lawyer in a city without laws? Eventually, the family sold the mildewing house, with its grand veranda and inner courtyard, and moved into a modest two-room flat, just a few miles from the house that had sheltered my grandmother on her first night in Calcutta. My father's fate, in contrast, mirrored that of his adopted city. Delhi, the capital, was India's overnourished child. Bolstered by the nation's aspirations to build a mega-metropolis, fattened by subsidies and grants, its roads widened and its economy expanded. My father rose through the ranks of a Japanese multinational firm, clambering swiftly from lower to upper middle class. Our neighborhood, once girded by forests of thorn bushes overrun with wild dogs and goats, was soon transformed into one of the most affluent pockets of real estate in the city. We vacationed in Europe. We learned to eat with chopsticks and swam in hotel pools in the summer. When the monsoons hit Calcutta, the mounds of garbage on the streets clogged the drains and turned the city into a vast infested swamp. One such stagnant pond, festering with mosquitoes, was deposited yearly outside Bulu's house. She called it her own swimming pool. There is something in that comment, a lightness, that was symptomatic. You might imagine that the sharp vicissitudes of fortune had reshaped Tulu and Bulu in drastically different ways. On the contrary, over the years, their physical resemblance had dwindled to the point of vanishing, but something ineffable about them, an approach, a temperament, remained remarkably similar and even amplified in its convergence. Despite the growing economic rift between the two sisters, they shared an optimism about the world, a curiosity, a sense of humor, an equanimity that borders on nobility but comes with no pride. When we traveled abroad, my mother would bring home a collection of souvenirs for Bulu, a wooden toy from Belgium, fruit-flavored chewing gum from America that smelled of no earthly fruit, or a glass trinket from Switzerland. My aunt would read travel guides of the countries that we had visited. "I've been there, too," she would say, arranging the souvenirs in a glass case, with no trace of bitterness in her voice. There is no word or phrase in the English language for that moment in a son's consciousness when he begins to understand his mother, not just superficially, but with the immersive clarity with which he understands himself. My experience of this moment, somewhere in the depths of my childhood, was perfectly dual. As I understood my mother, I also learned to understand her twin. I knew, with luminous certainty, when she would laugh, what made her feel slighted, what would animate her, or where her sympathies or affinities might lie. To see the world through the eyes of my mother was to also see it through the eyes of her twin, except, perhaps, with lenses tinted in slightly different colors. What had converged between my mother and her sister, I began to realize, was not personality, but its tendency, its first derivative, to borrow a mathematical term. In calculus, the first derivative of a point is not its position in space, but its propensity to change its position, not where an object is, but how it moves in space and time. This shared quality, unfathomable to some, and yet self-evident to a four-year-old, was the lasting link between my mother and her twin. Tulu and Bulu were no longer recognizably identical, but they shared the first derivative of identity. Anyone who doubts that genes can specify identity might well have arrived from another planet and failed to notice that the humans come in two fundamental variants, male and female. Cultural critics, queer theorists, fashion photographers, and Lady Gaga have reminded us accurately that these categories are not as fundamental as they might seem, and that unsettling ambiguities frequently lurk in their borderlands. But it is hard to dispute three essential facts: that males and females are anatomically and physiologically different, that these anatomical and physiological differences are specified by genes, and that these differences, interposed against cultural and social constructions of the self, have a potent influence on specifying our identities as individuals. That genes have anything to do with the determination of sex, gender, and gender identity is a relatively new idea in our history. The distinction between the three words is relevant to this discussion. By sex, I mean the anatomic and physiological aspects of male versus female bodies. By gender, I'm referring to a more complex idea, the psychic, social, and cultural roles that an individual assumes. By gender identity, I mean an individual's sense of self, as female versus male, as neither, or as something in between. For millennia, the basis of the anatomical dissimilarities between men and women, the anatomical dimorphism of sex, was poorly understood. In AD 200, Galen, the most influential anatomist in the ancient world, performed elaborate dissections to try to prove that male and female reproductive organs were analogs of each other, with the male organs turned inside out and the females turned outside in. The ovaries, Galen argued, were just internalized testicles retained inside the female body because females lacked some vital heat that could extrude the organs. "Turn outward the woman's organs and double the man's, and you will find the same," he wrote. Galen's students and followers stretched this analogy, quite literally, to its absurd point, reasoning that the uterus was the scrotum ballooning inward and that the fallopian tubes were the seminal vesicles blown up and expanded. The theory was memorialized in a medieval verse, an anatomical mnemonic for medical students. "Though they of different sexes be, yet on the whole they're the same as we. For those that have the strictest searchers been, find women are just men turned outside in." But what force was responsible for turning men inside out or women outside in, like socks? Centuries before Galen, the Greek philosopher Anaxagoras, writing around 400 BC, claimed that gender, like New York real estate, was determined entirely by location. Like Pythagoras, Anaxagoras believed that the essence of heredity was carried by male sperm, while the female only shaped male semen in the womb to produce the fetus. The inheritance of gender also followed this pattern. Semen produced in the left testicle gave rise to male children, while semen produced in the right testicle gave rise to females. The specification of gender continued in the womb, extending the left-right spatial code sparked off during ejaculation. A male fetus was deposited, with exquisite specificity, in the right horn of the uterus. A female, conversely, was nurtured in the left horn. It is easy to laugh Anaxagoras' theory off as anachronistic and bizarre. Its peculiar insistence on left and right placement, as if gender were determined by some sort of cutlery arrangement, clearly belongs to another era, but the theory was revolutionary for its time, for it made two crucial advances. First, it recognized that the determination of gender was essentially random, and so a random cause, the left or right origin of sperm, would need to be invoked to explain it. And second, it reasoned that once established, the original random act had to be amplified and consolidated to fully engender gender. The developmental plan of the fetus was crucial. Right-sided sperm found its way to the right side of the uterus, where it was further specified into a male fetus. Left-sided sperm was segregated to the left side to make a female child. Gender determination was a chain reaction, set off by a single step, but then amplified by the location of the fetus into the full-fledged dimorphism between men and women. And there, for the most part, sex determination sat, for centuries. Theories abounded, but conceptually they were variants of Anaxagoras' idea that sex was determined by an essentially random act, consolidated and amplified by the environment of the egg or fetus. "Sex is not inherited," one geneticist wrote in 1900. Even Thomas Morgan, perhaps the most prominent proponent of the role of genes in development, proposed that sex could not be determined through genes. In 1903, Morgan wrote that sex was likely determined by multiple environmental inputs rather than a single genetic one. The egg, as far as sex is concerned, appears to be in a sort of balanced state, and the conditions to which it is exposed may determine which sex it will produce. It may be a futile attempt to try to discover any one influence that has a deciding influence for all kinds of eggs. In the winter of 1903, the very year that Morgan had published his casual dismissal of a genetic theory of sex determination, Nettie Stevens, a graduate student, performed a study that would transform the field. Stevens was born to a carpenter in Vermont in 1861. She took courses to become a school teacher, but by the early 1890s had saved enough money from her tutoring jobs to attend Stanford University in California. She chose to attend graduate school in biology in 1900, an unusual choice for a woman in her time, and even more unusually, chose to perform field work at the zoological station in faraway Naples, where Theodore Boveri had collected his urchin eggs. She learned Italian so that she could speak the lingo of the local fishermen who brought her eggs from the shores. From Boveri, she learned to stain eggs to identify chromosomes, the strange blue-stained filaments that resided in cells. Boveri had demonstrated that cells with altered chromosomes could not develop normally, and so hereditary instructions for development had to be carried within chromosomes. But could the genetic determinant for sex also be carried by chromosomes? In 1903, Stevens chose a simple organism, the common mealworm, to investigate the correlation between an individual worm's chromosomal makeup and its sex. When Stevens used Boveri's chromosome staining method on male and female worms, the answer leaped out of the microscope. A variation in just one chromosome correlated perfectly with the worm's sex. Mealworms have 20 chromosomes in all, 10 pairs. Most animals have paired chromosomes. Humans have 23 pairs. Cells from female worms inevitably possess 10 matched pairs. Cells from male worms, in contrast, had 2 unpaired chromosomes, a small nub-like band and a larger chromosome. Stevens suggested that the presence of the small chromosome was sufficient to determine sex. She termed it the sex chromosome. To Stevens, this suggested a simple theory of sex determination. When sperm was created in the male gonad, it was made in 2 forms, one bearing the nub-like male chromosome and another bearing the normal-sized female chromosome, in roughly equal ratios. When sperm bearing the male chromosome, that is, male sperm, fertilized the egg, the embryo was born male. When female sperm fertilized an egg, the result was a female embryo. Stevens's work was corroborated by that of her close collaborator, the cell biologist Edmund Wilson, who simplified Stevens's terminology, calling the male chromosome Y and the female X. In chromosomal terms, male cells were XY and females were XX. The egg contains a single X chromosome, Wilson reasoned. When a sperm carrying a Y chromosome fertilizes an egg, it results in an XY combination and maleness is determined. When a sperm carrying an X chromosome meets a female egg, the result is XX, which determines femaleness. Sex was not determined by right or left testicles, but by a similarly random process, by the nature of the genetic payload of the first sperm to reach and fertilize an egg. The XY system discovered by Stevens and Wilson had an important corollary. If the Y chromosome carried all the information to determine maleness, then that chromosome had to carry genes to make an embryo male. At first, geneticists expected to find dozens of male-determining genes on the Y chromosome. Sex, after all, involves the exacting coordination of multiple anatomical, physiological, and psychological features, and it was hard to imagine that a single gene could be capable of performing such diverse functions all by itself. Yet careful students of genetics knew that the Y chromosome was an inhospitable place for genes. Unlike any other chromosome, the Y is unpaired. That is, it has no sister chromosome and no duplicate copy, leaving every gene on the chromosome to fend for itself. A mutation in any other chromosome can be repaired by copying the intact gene from the other chromosome, but a Y chromosome gene cannot be fixed, repaired, or recopied. It has no backup or guide. When the Y chromosome is assailed by mutations, it lacks a mechanism to recover information. The Y